little man.
This is Bob Frelick, co-host of Thinking Clearly. Besides the specific tools of critical thinking, like understanding how to construct sound arguments, vetting information for relevance and accuracy, the principles of logic, and so on, a number of key critical thinking-related items have been explored here on Thinking Clearly. For example, the nature of curiosity, having productive civil dialogues, the nature of science and science denial, and the nature of trust. In researching each of these issues, we realized that it would take more than one episode to explore the topic, and we wound up producing several shows on each. For example, after the first episode on trust, that was number 70, The Nature of Trust, which aired back in May of 2022, we immediately followed with two other shows on the topic. And now 3 years later, given the degree of mistrust prevalent in our country, it seems important to revisit that issue and comment on how critical thinking relies on being able to trust our sources of information and how the very functioning of our democracy depends on social trust and trust in our institutions. So with that in mind, you will now hear a replay of episode 70 with our regular introduction and the goodbye section edited out. And at the end, I'll make additional comments. So as you listen, remember that in May 2022, COVID was still widespread. And 2 years after the 2020 presidential election, the big lie that that election had been stolen from Donald Trump still prevailed. Enjoy.
Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
In this episode, Julie and I will focus on the issue of trust. We'll examine what it is. We'll give a sampling of some of the extensive research on trust, and we'll present results from survey information on trust. We're going to play a clip from recent recordings that I've made with a sampling of people talking about what they trust and what they don't trust. And we'll end with a discussion of how trust relates to being a critical thinker.
That's right. You know, trust has come up time and time again in a number of our episodes, and it seems to really permeate our lives in more ways than we probably realize day to day. And most importantly, you know, why we're talking about trust today is that it factors in our decision making, whether we realize it or not. You know, trust can also be tricky. It originates in our gut, as people say. It's an assessment that happens often in the background that we're not actively thinking about. And it's also not something that's exactly black and white as it is often made out to be. For instance, I may trust my father to help me buy a motorcycle, but I may not trust him to do my taxes. That doesn't take away from the trusting relationship I have with him. It speaks to the strengths and the evidence that I've seen throughout my life.
So it's situationally specific.
It can be. It can be situationally specific. And I think that's definitely a very important factor as trust plays in our day-to-day lives. You know, one thing that really stood out to me when, you know, I was trying to wrap my brain around, you know, why are we even talking about this as a topic? David Halpern, who is the UK's he's on the UK's Behavioral Insight Team, or more commonly known as the Nudge Unit. When he was asked what exactly is social trust, his answer was, it's just one of those things, right? It's sort of like the dark matter of the economy and society. It matters very greatly, and yet we don't seem to focus on it very much. So, you know, myself, as someone who's committed a lot of my life to social progress, I can't ignore the role that trust plays in shaping my relationships with my neighbors, my fellow community members, the people I work with, and the role trust plays when it comes to actions such as mutual aid, mutual understanding, and effectively creating a more just future. So that's where I'm coming from and why I found this really interesting topic. Maybe you want to tell us where you're coming from in regards to trust.
Trust is one of those things, and I found this out when I started trying to wrap my mind around trust. and do some real thinking about it and what it means to me. But I realized that it's been an important issue for me for a long time. And some of that I trace back to a memorable experience that I had with my best friend. I'm not going to give my best friend's name. I was age 12 at the time, and I trusted my friend without question. And just before I moved from the town in Montana where I lived to where my family was moving in California, he told me that he had really been friends for a long time with the rival kids several blocks away. And since we considered those kids our bitter enemies, that was, for me, a betrayal. So I think that experience kind of set the tone with people that I feel close to, that trust is a very sensitive issue for me. But as an adult, I trust individuals that have consistently shown that they genuinely care about what is in my best interest and also have good intentions and behavior toward other human beings in general. So there are some close friends and family members that I strongly trust, but people that I don't know well, I kind of put in a neutral category in my brain as trust unknown. So I guess for me, trust must be earned. For example, I might trust a healthcare worker who might be a doctor, a nurse, who remembers my name, health issues, takes the time to read my chart before they see me, and adequately answers my questions and does follow up on referrals. And so there are benchmarks, I guess, for trust. And so in a way, trust is earned, not given completely just to everybody right at first. And I think that's maybe a difference between people too. But thinking about groups or entities, I strongly trust scientific consensus. I trust well-constructed scientific research. And I trust some media sources. I don't have strong feelings of prejudicial distrust for government agencies, for example, the CDC or the EPA, or even, catch your breath on this one, Big Pharma, like some people do. Because, you know, I don't think of those entities as monolithic. I think of them as being made up of individuals. And some of those individuals might be trustworthy and some are not. In general, I think that people working at an organization like any of those I mentioned have some dedication to the mission of that organization and some pride in doing a good job. So when I'm looking at an organization, if they have a vision and mission statement, I look at that. I take it seriously. That sets the tone for the organization. That means something to me, and I'm aligned with those organizations then, or groups that I likely share values with. And I lean towards trust with them, unless, of course, I find out that organization isn't living up to the ideals, the vision, and mission statements. But thinking about trust, it brings up a lot of questions. For example, is trust given or earned or both? Has trust become weaponized? I believe it has, as information has. And is trust increasingly being used as a rhetorical or a propaganda device to promote beliefs and persuade others? So those are all questions that have to do with topics that we've been talking for a long time about on Thinking Clearly. So I think the topic is very appropriate for this show, very crucial for our civilization, and really relevant to critical thinking. So let's maybe start with a definition of trust.
That's right. We talk a lot about critical thinking. One of the places you have to start is by defining your terms. Otherwise, how do you even know what you're talking about? And trust is one of those that can be slippery to hold on to. It depends on if you're talking to a neuropsychologist, an economic specialist, a counselor, or your teacher. They're all going to kind of have different perspectives on trust. For this purpose, we're turning to a definition in a paper published by the Journal of Occupational Psychology, which says trust, to the extent to which one is willing to ascribe good intentions to and have confidence in the words and actions of other people. And this could also be, of course, extended to organizations and institution, but sometimes what's called, generalized trust. Just basically, do you trust other people? it can also be described as the feeling that we can rely on the character, ability, strength, or truth of someone, some group, or entity.
It wasn't a research article, but it was an article in Psychology Today that caught my eye by Mariana Pogosyan. And the word trust has in its origins, according to Mariana, in the Indo-European root word, draust, which means solid or lasting. And then she goes on to say, in Old English, it referred to confidence and dependence. But then in the 14th century, Chaucer used the word trust to mean virtual certainty and well-grounded hope. So that's pretty much the present-day meaning of trust for most people. And trust is an essential ingredient for thriving in interpersonal relationships, from friends to families and organizations. So it's worthy of more than one episode of Thinking Clearly as we get into the various layers of this. This is meant to be only an introduction, a Bob and Julia introduction to trust and the importance of trust, especially to critical thinkers. And according to Pogosyan, trust and reciprocity are considered to be the basis of all human systems of morality. And not only is trust a lubricant for social functioning, as she puts it, but it's part of the nation's social capital. Trust affects vital economic variables such as the GDP, growth, and inflation rates. And my own personal thoughts as I was reading Pogosyan's article go back to the evolutionary perspective. And we know that our complex social and cultural capabilities in leading to social cooperation have been so useful to us as Homo sapiens. So trust as a social lubricant, and I love the phrase, has been critical to our species development. Also, since we're able to learn what can be trusted to happen, in other words, accurately predict the behavior of humans and other animals and other things in our environment, that ability to accurately predict behavior and what's going to happen in our environment has given us such a huge survival and reproductive advantage. So that's kind of taking a look at the perspective from evolution and our history. Now, going back to what Pogosyan says in that Psych Today article, she says that researchers in social psychology differentiate between two kinds of trust, affective and cognitive. See, Julia, if this reminds you of something that we've talked about a lot on this program, cognitive trust is based on our knowledge and evidence about those that we choose to trust, and affective trust, on the other hand, is born out of our emotional ties with people, including the security and the confidence we place in others based on the feelings generated by our interactions. Does that ring any kind of bell about something we've talked a lot about?
Well, it reminds me of you and your friend at 12.
Yeah, that. And it kind of, in a way, parallels what we talked about as System 1 and System 2 thinking, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Where system one is the more intuitive, connected to our emotionality thinking.
The gut origin.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting here because what you're describing is how trust exists in both those systems, both the intuitive gut impulse, yes, emotional trust, as well as our sort of analytical predictive trust.
Yeah. And we might get a hit from a person that they can be trusted. And then when we look into their background, that's why they do background checks in when they're employing somebody, right? They did very well in the interview. You do a background check on them and find out that they're going to be your worst nightmare from the information that's gleaned from the background report. So all these kinds of ideas kind of begin to tie together. Well, Mariana Pogosyan is kind of a specialist in intercultural or cross-cultural psychology. So she went out and asked a whole bunch of people from different parts of the world what trust is, complete the sentence trust is. And I can't read them all because she did a lot of them, but I'm going to read a couple of them or a few of them. The first one is from a 52-year-old person from the Netherlands who said, trust is feeling safe. And then a 30-something from Mozambique said, trust is the absence of deception or fear from one person to another. And then a 30-something person from Italy said, trust is leaving questions and control behind. An elder, 87-year-old Armenian person said, trust is when you can tell your heart's secrets to another and know that they will not betray you. And my favorite comes from a 37-year-old person from Scotland who said, trust is what I see written on the face of my daughter every time she looks at me. Implicit faith that I will protect her and care for her no matter what.
What a variety of responses.
Yeah, and it's always, we get so fixated on our own culture and what's happening in America here because there's so much going on that sometimes we forget that there's another part of the world out there. And so it's good to get in information about people and how people think and react and behave in other parts of the world other than the United States.
In other recent shows, as recently as our last show, you know, we also talk about the influences of lived experience, what it's like to walk through this world as the unique individual person that you are. And I imagine, too, that is also reflective in a lot of that feedback. People, whether what country they came from, their age, their family makeup, you know, seems to have an influence on how they describe trust based on their lived experiences.
Yeah. We already alluded to the idea that there's a lot of research being done on trust, and I came across an article, another article in Psychology Today, October 9th, 2018, if you want to look it up. And I'm going to actually post the link to this article on our Facebook page. It's by Paul Thiegard. He's a professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and he said this. This is a quote. Trust is a brain process that binds representations of the self, other, situation, and emotion. Representations of self, other, situation, and emotion, four different elements there, into a special pattern of neural firing called a semantic pointer. Now, I have no idea what a semantic pointer is. So I will be buying that book that he's written, which is called, he wrote it in 2019, Mind Society from Brains to Social Sciences and Professions, because I was just intrigued by this article and I understood part of it now, but there was a lot of nuance and depth in that article. It was a short article that I didn't pick up on. So I'm going to go back and take another dip by buying his book. But I think he's saying that in our brains that we have the ability through the complexity of our 60 trillion neuronal connections. That's what gives us all the cognitive power that we have, is the interconnection between our neurons in our brain. And at any rate, with that, we're able to represent and bind together a mental picture of ourselves and bind that together with another set of neuronal connections. And by the way, our picture of ourselves includes our goals and our needs in a particular situation. And we bind that together with an appraisal of some other agent. It could be a person or a group, as being willing and able, from what we know about them, to help us meet those goals and needs. And we bind those then to an associated positive emotion for the person. So we get that feeling. We can trust that person. It's not really considered an emotion in psychology. Trust is not considered an emotion. It's given the term for most people that I've seen talking about it as a feeling. But he really gets into the kind of neuroscience and cognitive science detail in that book. So I'm really anxious to get it. But we bind all those together, and that leads us to that gut level feeling that we can trust the person. Any thoughts about that?
It just sounds really interesting, and it makes me wonder why I can't remember what I went into the other room to get if my brain is, you know, capable of doing all of these amazing processes all at once, and yet I have the short-term memory of a goldfish. It's an incredible organ, isn't it?
Yeah. I thought it might bring up some ideas about cross-cultural or intercultural ideas that you had.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the important parts, we often talk about how our brain functions both as a tool and sometimes, you know, can also inhibit us from performing our best critical thinking and our best analytical tasks, because it is an imperfect organ. You know, so our brain can be prone to errors. We talk about that all the time. Sometimes we talk about different kind of fallacies that our brain may commit. And, you know, in this case, I think something that is difficult to talk about, but is important that we talk about, is that some of those errors our brain make are also reflected as prejudice, whether it's about income class, ethnicity, race, age. And anyways, there's been a number of studies in this area. It's been studied for many, many decades. But recent studies indicate that people are more likely to express greater trust in and act trustworthy toward those who are perceived to be more like themselves. And we often see a lot of the times that homogenous societies have greater levels of trust because people are simply more alike. People assess presumed in-group members more positively, have greater expectations of fairness from those in-group members, and cooperate more with them by allocating greater resources to those in-group members. So, you know, we're always rooting for our own. We're on a team, whether we even realize it or not. And for instance, when paired with a partner of a different race, study participants acted less trustworthy, we're going to talk about the trust money game in a little bit, but when paired with people of a different race, that participants sent less money back on average than those partnered with someone of the same race. And actually, in another experiment that deployed a similar design, they also found that trust was greater between same race pairs than between different race pairs, and that people were more generous in the initial giving investment, and then were also generous in giving it back, both the trustor and the trustee. So these are, you know, things that are happening without us even realizing it, that we are assessing people as part of our team, for lack of a better word, without even realizing that we're on a team. And if we really want to be in a less racist society, this is an example of why we need to be proactively anti-racist, because our biological and cognitive roots are, you know, prejudice.
Yeah, very good. You know, one of the things that when we talked about doing a show, one of the episodes of Thinking Clearly on Trust, that popped into my head is, would it be interesting to get my recorder out and record a number of people saying what they trust and what they don't trust? Because I really wondered if people trust and don't trust the same things I trust and don't trust. So I did that, and I put together and edited out some of a longer version of what people talked about, put that together into a clip. So I'm going to play that clip, and these are real people discussing what they trust and what they don't trust.
Trust in my immediate family and circle of friends, of regular friends that we check in with each other, do our dailies, talk multiple times a week, if not every day, and check in with each other to see how we're doing and what we've got planned. And I trust that they'll be the same, have the same level of responsiveness and ability to listen and connect, relate back. The people I don't trust are people that have a recognizable behavior of wanting to con you a little bit, see what their angle is, opportunist, where I've developed over the years a little radar for when somebody is trying to work you a little bit, con you. I don't trust news reports that are clearly pre-biased with spin to create a political narrative.
These days, I tend to trust things that I can observe myself and research myself. When it comes to media, it's a little harder to trust these days. I think everybody feels that way. But I think it's coming from some sort of truth that there's a lot more bias in the media, and it's much more obvious these days. So it's very difficult to trust one source. So it's important to collect many sources on one topic and then sort it out for yourself. But I hope that we can regain that somehow, and we can have especially media outlets that everybody can trust, left, right, and in the middle. I think that's going to be crucial moving forward for the country. When it comes to other institutions, I can't say I really trust the institution, because all institutions are made out of people, and those people change and their policies change. So my trust is based on the people in charge at the time.
The people I trust in my own life would be my close family and close friends, people that I've had a lot of history with that I feel are my close circle. I think that they're trustworthy with what information I'm giving them, that they're going to keep it private. But also, I trust, you know, what information they're giving me is, for as much as they know, is accurate. I don't always think that the people I trust do have accurate information. It kind of depends on where they're getting their information from, but I can trust that they are trying to give the right information as best as they know it. I worked for a school district, so are the teachers in the classroom doing the best they can? I think so. Can I trust a lot of the teachers? Yes, I would think so. They mostly go into that profession because they love kids and want to do good for kids. In teaching, personally, with the people that were higher up, I wanted to know more of a background for them. And were they teachers before they became administrators or higher up in the district? Do they have an understanding of what maybe families need, kids need, the decisions that they're making, and understand how they play out further, how those decisions really do matter as they trickle down to that small person, which in this case would be a small little child that's counting on people to do the right thing. My loss of trust as a bigger organization would go back into like more of a religious, growing up with a born-again Christian group, which I don't want to hurt a lot of people's feelings, but just the experience of being in something that I thought was true and felt true and valid with the way that people treated me when I was little through it, you know, love God, someone's watching over you. Those are always things you want to know or you hope for because they feel good. But it's kind of like waiting for Santa on Christmas morning. As a kid, you love that. But then later, Santa's not real. And so it changes the feeling of that. Now with religion, it's a lot more complicated. But my experience in that was trusting a system where I thought the people that were in it, you know, all the different people as a whole or the pastors were pretty trustworthy. But then as I got older, I found it getting more and more judgmental and used against me and as a means of controlling my decisions and not necessarily of being supportive. So I lost a lot of trust for that as it got used against me instead of to build me up, I guess, and help me grow.
I'm 4 years old. Trust means that you know when people are not gonna like hurt you. If you trust them, that means it, and it's good. I trust Mommy and Daddy. I trust Coy and Scotty.
Well, what do you think, Julia?
That was a very interesting sampling. I think it really touched on a lot of different aspects of very real world everyday trust.
And it was enjoyable doing, but I contacted and asked a whole lot more people than actually decided to be recorded. So I didn't think I'd have as much trouble actually getting interviews as I did.
Why do you think it was so difficult for you?
Probably because they didn't trust me. I don't know. I don't know. No, I think it's a, first of all, I think it's a hard subject for people to think about, because the people that I did get an interview out of, all except the four-year-old, who was pretty spontaneous, had to think about it a little bit, said, I'll think about that and then, you know, get back to me. So they actually gave it some thought ahead of time, because I think it's a topic that most people don't really think about consciously much.
Which is why we're talking about it today. I am curious if you have a sense of those who did not partake in the interview, if it was, you know, truly, was it a lack of trust of what you would do with the interview, or what a trust in themselves and what they would say?
Well, I think a lot of it is just a lot of people don't like to be recorded. They don't like the mic, you know. So I think a part of it was that. I think that they were not so sure that they had anything very wise to say about the issue. So there was, it was a little different from person to person. So I can't make any generalizations other than many people are just very hesitant to be recorded on something that personal nature.
And there's a lot of vulnerability when we talk about trust and we think about who we do and we don't trust and why.
Exactly. Well, let's move to doing some discussion of some research on trust, because there's been a lot of research on trust, but we're just going to do a little sampling here and give an idea right here at the start of, you mentioned the trust game, what that is, because it's a major research paradigm that is used by people who are looking into trust, be they from economics or social psychology, cognitive science. And what this game is all about is that there are two players, and they sequentially send money to each other. And the first player, we'll call him the trustor, can choose to place a large sum of money in the hands of the second player. And the amount of money then is tripled by the experimenter, and the trustor knows this. The second player can then choose to send some amount back to the sender. Because the second player is not obliged to reciprocate, there's no mandatory that you have to give money back to the person that gave it to you. So the second person could keep all the gains for themselves. But because this possibility of betrayal of the initial investment is thought to be a very good simulation of many real-life situations involving trust. So this game has been used by many, many researchers, and there's hundreds of studies with trust that have yielded some fascinating insights into psychology, and there are different ways that that game is played depending on what the researcher is really looking for.
And I've even heard of animal behavioral researchers using variations of this game. It's a really kind of interesting way to assess two people's trust in each other. So, you described it very well, you know, and this is radio. Sometimes it can be a bit to wrap our head around it. So to, you know, kind of describe how this game would go, say you're the first player, the trustor. Mm-hmm. And you're given, the experimenter says, here's $100, Bob. And I'll be the second player, the trustee. And so where do we go from here? You have $100 given to you by the experimenter.
Yes. Well, I can take that $100 and keep all of it if I want. Or I can pass any portion of that on to the second player, to you. I could give you half, a third, 90%. I could give you all of it. It's up to me. And then you make the decision as to how much of that you're going to keep. You could...
There's a little factor in there, which is, so you're given $100.
Well, I forgot that. That's very important.
and you choose anywhere from 0 to 100 to give back to me.
Right.
This is a weird little caveat. The experimenter then triples what you've decided to give to me. So if you decide to give me $1, I get $3.
Exactly.
If you decide to give me $100, I get $300.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. And then you make the decision how much, if any, to pass back to me. And so that's the simulation of trust. Now, if you didn't pass any back to me, then you know, I would consider you untrustworthy. You had an opportunity to reciprocate because trust is really based on reciprocation. And that's its strength in terms of being a social lubricant, is that reciprocation fosters social cooperation. So that game has been played in many versions, in many laboratories, for many different reasons, looking at different hypotheses.
And I think it's worth pointing out, too, by the experimenter tripling what is given to the second player, there is the opportunity for a great deal of mutual benefit.
Yes.
So, for instance, if you decide to give me $1 out of your 100, and that becomes $3 for me, and then I, in turn, maybe I give you half back, I give you $1.50. So you've now made 50 cents and I've made $1.50 that wasn't there before. It all came from the experimenter. Now, say you're in an extremely generous mood and you give me all $100. That then becomes $300. So we've now tripled our collective money. And, you know, if I was of, you know, equitable mind, maybe I give you half back. So you have $150, I have $150, and both of us come out of this experiment a heck of a lot better.
Yeah.
I think that's one little caveat to throw in there, is that this is not a zero-sum game. You know, by trusting each other, we mutually, collectively have a lot to gain.
Yeah. And that's why it represents a paradigm that assesses trust and societal trust, especially. So give us a little sampling of what some of researchers have learned from that.
There's, you know, all kinds of, we'll just kind of do these out in tidbits, I guess, kind of summarize the key points, you know. But a lot of different insights have come from experimenting with this game. You know, it's found that oxytocin, which is a natural hormone, a neurotransmitter, has been shown to increase trust. Likely by suppressing the neural system that regulates our fear of betrayal. You know, folks who have heard of oxytocin before, you know, often hear it referred to as, you know, the love drug, the coupling drug, the attachment drug. You know, it's it plays a big role in social bonding and is created in our own body, in our hypothalamus, and released into the bloodstream. And so that's something that's happening beneath the surface, if you will, unseen, that influences our ability to trust other people. The inverse of that, on the flip, is when we feel negative emotions, we're less likely to trust other people. So maybe something bad has happened in my life. My car just broke down. I can't trust my car anymore. And that then influences, permeates into the rest of my life about how I feel about the world and the people around me, as an example. We also base our decisions about whom to trust on their attractiveness, how much they resemble our kin members, or, you know, the familiarity of the team we talked about earlier, as well as facial features. One study, for instance, shows that males with relatively wider faces, which is associated with testosterone, having a lot of testosterone, that they were less likely to be trusted during this game. And then it may not come as a surprise. Women tend to reciprocate their wealth in the trust game more than men, you know, which, again, probably wouldn't come as a surprise. Risk-averse people often find it harder to trust as frequently as those who are more comfortable in taking risks. So risk, that I think that's a really interesting one, too, because that their trust is, again, being influenced by one's internal disposition, whether or not they're risk averse or comfortable with risk. Trust in strangers increases from childhood to early adulthood and then remains more or less stable in adulthood. So maybe if you had your experience with your best friend at 18 instead of 12, you would have had a very different takeaway from that, I would suspect. And then, as you know, we had touched on earlier, that there are different levels of trust across cultures. Cultures have very different values. They have different history. They lead to different lived experiences. You know, so for instance, Americans are more trusting of others than compared to, say, the Japanese or Germans when playing this trust game. As an example, So those are some little tidbits. There's, like I said, there's been a lot of research specifically using this trust game and variations of it. And these are some of the insights that have come from those experiments.
Yeah, and that last one sort of throws me a little bit. It's not intuitive. I always think of Americans as less trusting than Japanese. I'd have to look into that and see what they did and how they did that research. But we want to shift now from some of the, you know, this is laboratory research that's being done to survey research that's being done on trust. We'll have more to say, I'm sure, about trust and political polarization in a future episode. So let's go to some of the observations that were shared in a 2020 post that I came across by Professor Kevin Vallier. And he's a professor from Bowling Green University. And this was on the Knight Foundation webpage. I'll put a link on our Facebook page to this. It starts out a number of findings. And one was that Americans are finding it harder and harder to trust one another. Social trust, which is our trust of our fellow citizens, has fallen dramatically. For example, back in the 70s, around half of Americans said that most people can be trusted, and today that figure's less than a third.
In political trust, trust in governments and democracy has fallen steeply in the U.S. as well, probably no surprise, especially those of us who have lived through the last 5 years. But throughout the 1960s, over 70% of Americans said they trusted government in Washington always or most of the time. By the early 1990s, the number had fallen below 30%, and it has collapsed to 17% as of 2019. More troublesome still is that Americans reporting no confidence at all in their national government doubled from around 14% between 1995 and 2011 to 28% then in 2017. But again, coming back to cultural differences, it's not like that everywhere. We're talking specifically about surveys in America. The Netherlands, for instance, had pretty similar levels of social trust in the 1980s as compared to America and the UK. But whereas we have now drifted downwards, the Netherlands has drifted upwards, close to 70% in levels of those who think others can be trusted. David Halpern, who I had mentioned earlier, he's part of the UK's Nudge Unit, speculates that, you know, of course, we have to be careful about using specific countries as examples. He does point out that the Netherlands has wrestled quite hard and actively with the issue of not just inequality, but social differences. They're a very diverse nation, especially Amsterdam being a hub of multiculturalism. And they've really put a concerted effort in building social cohesion and mending these sorts of differences between people. And they've actively tried to make diverse groups get along with each other. And again, they also have a culture to draw on, which, you know, has a strong sense of law and trustworthiness, where contracts are expected to be honored. And that's helped them economically through the centuries. But I just want to take a minute to kind of contrast those two different surveys, in that we started in a very similar place in the 1980s when it comes to trust. But the actions we took since then, whether proactively or reactively, have taken us in such different directions. And so I just want to point that out, because there are things that we can do to cultivate trust in society.
Another point that Vallier made in this post on the Knight Foundation webpage was that we see a similarly disturbing pattern in partisan trust. For example, in 2017, around 70% of the Republicans said they distrusted anyone who voted for Hillary Clinton for president. And likewise, around 70% of Democrats said they distrusted people who voted for Donald Trump. So people not only distrust politicians from the other party, they distrust anyone who votes for the other party. And that's millions of people. So in our politically polarized age, we trust each other less, simply based on how we vote.
You know, worse there is distrust is giving way to darker impulses like hatred. From 1980, when the measurement began, some members of each political party reported that they hated one another, but they used to be far fewer in number, between 10 and 20% of each party. In 2000, something changed. Now, as many as half of the members of each party despise each other. It's unclear how democracy can remain stable under these conditions when you have such a birth between parties.
Yeah. And people are earnestly worried about our democracy for all kinds of different reasons. But trust is right up there as being a primary reason for worrying about where we are, not only in the United States, but in the world. Well, worst of all is a Pew poll that was taken back in 2018, I guess, that breaks down trust levels by age. And the most trusting Americans are those over 65, whereas the least trusting by far are the youngest. So in 2018, around 29% of Americans over 65 said that most people cannot be trusted. So 29% of people over 65 said most people cannot be trusted. Now that's sad, but 60% of Americans 18 to 29 agree with that statement that most people cannot be trusted. And one thing we know from the trust research is that trust levels tend to harden in early adulthood. So we, by that, can infer a very low trust future.
You know, trust is something to be concerned about going forward, but it's also underlined in a lot of the efforts that, you know, we take part in as a society. It may not be the number one issue, but it might be an underlying priority behind that issue. Of course, the pandemic is on our minds a lot lately and has been for a couple years. So, you know, there's definitely something worth talking about there with the pandemic and trust. You had found an interesting resource, which was the Edelman Trust Barometer. That can be found at edelman.com/trust. And it had some really key findings as far as having successful vaccination efforts. And those were to have successful vaccination efforts, it requires trust in scientists who create the vaccine, companies that manufacture the vaccine, the healthcare workers who inject the vaccine, the government that oversees the process and the regulations. And trust in government was the strongest predictor of the willingness to be immunized.
And Edelman they're a global communications firm, and they've been doing those surveys for about 22 years. So I will also post a link to the Edelman Trust Barometer, and you can look at that because they go back to 22 years of doing these surveys on trust. Yeah, it kind of parrots how I felt about the pandemic when it first started. I was optimistic that it would bring higher levels of trust because we have a common enemy and we would have more social cooperation. And I went on record on this show of saying that, you know, I think this is going to bring us together. We have a common enemy, this virus, you know. And boy, was I wrong about that.
It was a simpler time then, Bob. It was a simpler time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you've had a little experience with conversations about vaccines and that kind of stuff in the work that you do. Do you have any feelings about how trust actually enters into the picture?
I'm really sympathetic to a lot of different perspectives, and I think we have kind of differentiated between trust in each other, trust in individuals, and trust in systems and organizations. And, you know, I can say that for most of my life, I have not trusted the American healthcare system. That doesn't mean I necessarily don't trust healthcare workers, but I see a system that is designed by capitalism to create wealth before health. For me, it's been very important to kind of make that differentiation that there's a lot of trustworthy individuals stuck in a system that is not trustworthy. And how to navigate that is incredibly difficult. And I don't have an answer. But I do think it's important to make those differentiations, that there's a lot of really good people, really trustworthy, smart, caring people who are, and I'm not just talking about healthcare workers, but generally speaking, who are stuck in systems that we have good reason not to trust.
And you mentioned the relationship of the economic system that we live in, the form of government and trust. The talking points that we talked about that came from Kevin Volier. We did some bullet points from information from him. He wrote a book, Trust in a Polarized Age, and I have that book, and I'm starting to read it. And so he talks about that in quite depth in terms of the relationship between trust and constitutional values and moral values in the system that we live in. And he has a little more hope and optimism that that can be remediated and that trust can be rebuilt. And I've just started that book, but I'm interested in getting more involved in reading that book. It's a very detailed philosophical, research-centric book, and I'm really enjoying that. Well, let's move towards, as we usually do, talking about the topic that we're talking about and how it relates to critical thinking. You might be asking, why are they talking about trust here? This is a show about critical thinking. Well, it's, in my way of thinking, very, very related to critical thinking, because critical thinking rests on forming conclusions which are logically warranted by good evidence, as we've talked about much on this show. And good evidence means that it's relevant to our logical argument and that we've vetted the evidence. And we've done a number of shows on how to vet evidence and vet arguments and vet claims from other people. And vetting evidence means that we've determined the primary source of where did that evidence come from. And we've evaluated the methods that were used in collecting that evidence and the credentials of the source of the person disseminating the evidence. So it's a complex world that we live in. And we have really, when you think about it, very limited real knowledge stored away in our heads. And we don't usually have the facts of the matter for any issue that we're considering already stored away in our brains. And so even if we are doing our own research, as we suggest everyone who's a critical thinker does, we really have limited background knowledge to adequately evaluate vetted evidence. We can find out who the source is and what the credentials are. But once we do that, then we have to decide whether we trust that source. I started out when I talked about my comments and feelings about trust, that I trust the scientific process. I trust scientific consensus. Now, scientific consensus isn't always easy to find. There's no one website that gives scientific consensus on all issues. I'd love to find that if it does exist.
And it's subject to change.
And it's subject to change all the time. It's a lot of work because you have to survey everybody in a certain field, and that's hard to do. So it's not always easy to determine what scientific consensus is, but if and when it is determined, I have a great deal of trust that scientific consensus is as close as I can get to the right answer at this particular time about evidence. So as critical thinkers, it's very relevant to decide and think about who you trust, what do you trust, what sources do you trust, and why do you trust them?
That why is a big one. That's a lot lies in that why. And I would be remiss if I did not include, when it comes to the role trust plays in critical thinking, I would be remiss not to mention the appeal to trust fallacy, which is basically the appeal to trust fallacy says source X is a trusted source on information. Claim Y was made by source X. Therefore, claim Y must be true. It's kind of like saying Gwyneth Paltrow is a very good actress. Therefore, I turn to her for health recommendations.
Yeah. So we have to evaluate the relevance of the person's expertise to the field. And that can be problematic sometimes because, and the other part of this is that even if a person is, let's say, a scientist, there's always outliers. You know, when you have any group, you're going to have people on the extreme ends of the bell-shaped curve. So there's always outliers and there are always scientists who can give credentials and have a very, very different opinion than the consensus in the field. And oftentimes people who are biased towards not believing the conventional wisdom and scientific consensus will find somebody that has the credentials, looks good according to their bio that they are able to put up, but is a real outlier. So that has to be taken into consideration. Something really important to know is the person, because they have the credentials, are they really in alignment with most other experts in the field?
And are they speaking to their expertise? You know, it brings me right back to the top of the show. My father is an excellent person to take if you need to buy a motorcycle. He's an expert on motorcycles, but I would not trust him to do my taxes. And that doesn't speak to him as a value judgment as a person at all. It's that is not his realm of expertise. But the appeal to fallacy would say, but you trust him, don't you?
So there's a lot to this. What I'm finding is I'm said to myself, oh, trust would be a good topic to have one episode of Thinking Clearly. As with everything in terms of the kinds of things we discuss on this show, there are many, many layers. And what I find, and it's kind of frustrating, but it's also very energizing. Just when I think I have a grasp on something, I begin to know enough to see that there are all these other layers. And it becomes much more complex and nuanced than I thought going in. That has played itself out repeatedly with the kinds of topics that we've been doing on Thinking Clearly.
Well, here's to another 5 to 6 years of revisiting the topics that we can't get enough of.
And back to the present. In 2025, Bob Frelick here, making some brief updated comments about trust. The rampant spread of misinformation creates a domino effect, which causes people to lose trust in the traditional sources of information like medical professionals and experts in other areas. And that then begins generalizing to a loss of trust in entire fields of studies, kindling science denialism and further spreading to loss of trust in our political institutions and to the very foundations of our democratic system. As pointed out by historian and public intellectual Yuval Noah Harari, who said, quote, democracy thrives on trust. Dictatorships thrive on fear. When trust erodes, when people no longer believe in elections, institutions, or truth itself, democracy collapses. Julia and I are very appreciative of you, our listeners. So we want to thank you very much for your support and interest in learning and using critical thinking. You are the hope for rebuilding trust. And until next time, keep thinking clearly.